I'd like to welcome you all to a retreat together, a metta retreat. And I'd also like to express my great joy in being here with you. So far away from where I live, up in the mountains in New Mexico in the United States, and feeling so warmly welcomed here. It's really a great pleasure to be with you. It's a great honor, actually, and a pleasure to begin to spend the next 5 days together in a really particular and quite unique and special way. So we have something kind of incredible that we're entering into together these next days. As we enter into retreat, each one of us alone and together as a group, we're creating a temporary village, a temporary community together, a community of spiritual life together, spiritual practice. And even if it's brand new for you, the very first time for some of you, you may have a sense of a kind of entry into a sacred space, a sanctuary. I know every time I enter into teaching a retreat or enter into a period of intensive personal practice, I have this feeling inside me of entering into a sacred space, entering into a kind of sanctuary. And here the sacred space is quite all-inclusive. Our surroundings around us, the life around us, this beautiful place, and the sacredness within us also. The sacred space around us is really quite a profound teacher, potentially a very profound teacher. All of the rhythms of life happening that we're so close to here, the change in the light, the dark, the day to night, light to dark, continual changes. Whoops. The lights go out and then they go on. If I can see my notes, I'll be doing well. And then we're also in the process of a beginning of a seasonal change from winter to spring that will touch very deeply in these days together. The smells, the changes in the growing things, the various forms of life that will begin to emerge. And we'll be very close to that. All the creatures, the birds, all the growing things, the trees, the myriad forms of growth that are abundant here and growing more and more each day now as spring starts to come in. The air itself, the wind this afternoon, the changes in the air, very dramatic and very close, right here, right with us. It's a great gift that we're not separate from, and that we will have a chance, the opportunity to really connect closely with. It's a great gift that holds us in it. I think of being held in the natural world. As a teacher, as a gift, and as a reflection for the naturalness of ourselves, our nature as nature, not different from the nature surrounding us. The amazing thing is that we quite often forget is that nature is no problem to itself. It's no problem to itself in itself. It just is. And we're not different than that, actually. We are nature ourselves. So we get to see this reflection continually in this world that we're living in our village here for the next 5 days. I think it's no surprise in this respect that us humans are really drawn to places of natural beauty, natural life, less constructed, less tame life, because it really mirrors us. It mirrors our truth, the truth of who we are, in such an easy way, such an accessible way. We like to sit on the earth at times, walk in the fields, walk in the hills, walk by the sea, as I did the other day for a couple of hours. And our heart opens in these times. Often our heart just opens wide, a sense of connection in this heart opening. These moments of simple presence, actually. We feel the energy and the sense of connection, say, in an early morning, in a spring rain, which we may very well experience during these days. The evening sunset, the early morning sunrise, again, so available, so present for us to be present in. These are the moments that often we do feel, when we take the time to connect, to be present, where we do feel this heart connection, the heart opening and connecting. We feel not separate from, we sense ourselves as whole, as connected, as part of, not separate, not solid, not static, but part of this process of nature that we are. I would imagine that just about probably everyone in this room has had some exceptional, unexpected, sort of unsuspected moments during these times of simple being, simple presence, however they've come to you. Moments of a kind of unfettered, unbound attention. We could call it a spiritual attention. Our heart opens with ease in the midst of this simple presence. And it's as though we kind of fall through ourselves, fall through appearances, fall through ourselves, our usual self, into a very intuitive place, a place of the essence of things of which we are. And we touch that essence of boundless wonder. Our heart opens with what I think of sometimes as a radical acceptance of life, of ourself in that life. A radical acceptance, the sense of connection. And then maybe just for a second, we might dissolve with a boundless heart, just for a second, out of our seemingly separate, solid, static self, into this surprise of a moment. The surprise of the reflection of the wonder and the truth. The reflection of our heart's connection. A simple, unconditional moment. And we might say we're in love in that moment. It's a moment of being in love. In the truth of things, in the truth of ourselves. Um, someone you all know of, Albert Einstein, who recently was just called by a friend of ours a great Dharma teacher. He had something to say about this, and I'd like to read a piece of what he had to say. He said, "A human being is a part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences herself or himself, her thoughts, feelings, his thoughts, feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty." This is our potential, our possibility. In a place like this, where we are here, this whole complex of life here, there's an enormous amount of accumulated energy. All the people that have come here to practice, to learn, to do inner work, to explore, to investigate the nature of things, the true nature of things, in various ways. All of the various kinds of teachings that have been offered here. This energy, this accumulated energy that we are partaking of, that we are sharing in, and that we are adding to as we explore our nature for the next few days together. It's a great gift for us also. Also, at a place like this, we're really well taken care of. And in that taking care of, we all share also by each of us taking some small task, some small job each day that helps create a harmonious flow of life in our village here. So we're well taken care of. All of our basic needs are met in a very simple way, very simple and beautiful way. Life is kind of pared down, simplified from, for most of us anyway, our more complicated, usual daily life. There's not really hardly anything to do here. Very little to do. It's a great gift. We're well supported, well taken care of. And in this culture, as in where I live in the United States, it seems that it's not really particularly encouraged or generally supported to take time and energy in the way that we're doing here. To take the time and energy to really look inward. So we're incredibly fortunate to be in a place together, this place where it's honored, really honored and supported. And so as we begin together in this sanctuary, this sacred place that we're helping to create, it's a place of safety. It's a place of protection. It's a place of great respect and honor, a place of very deep acceptance, a place of reverence for the natural world around us and in us. It's an incredible gift that you've each given yourself to be here this weekend. Or this more than weekend, this 5 days. And it's a great gift that you also give each other. The gift in your presence here is a gift for every other being that's here. We actually hold each other in this process together as we hold ourselves. And this is the beginning of our metta practice, this gift that we offer ourselves and each other. The metta practice, the cultivation of the heart, cultivation of friendship, cultivation of unconditional kindness, care, love. This is the beginning of our practice. As we enter into retreat, as we enter into our inner life, alone and together in the silence, we're actually entering into what is the most intimate experience of our life, this intimacy with ourself. And as it unfolds, it becomes the deepest intimacy with all of life, all of life. We're entering into a very profound intimacy through our spiritual practice. This metta practice, the cultivation of the quality of our heart, of loving kindness, friendship, this quality that each one of us really honor and deeply cherish, have a great respect for. This is a training, this practice is a training of our heart, a training of our heart towards friendship, towards unconditional love and care. And we begin with ourselves in this practice, entering into this heart of intimacy, of friendship with ourselves. And then as the days go on, we begin to bring in all many of the rest of the forms of life. But we begin with ourselves. This is from an Indian teacher, Nisargadatta, very amazing teacher who is no longer alive. And he dialogued with his students. His way of teaching was dialogue. A student once asked him a question, "What can make me love?" And Nisargadatta answered, "You are love itself when you're not afraid." And then another student said, "What is love?" Nisargadatta answered, "When the sense of distinction and separation is absent, you may call it love." He went on to say that separation goes against fact. Things and people are different, but they're not separate. Nature is one. Reality is one. I'd like to say a few words about another really important aspect of the retreat that I know Oren mentioned in the talk earlier, and that's the silence. This is another gift, incredible gift of spending 5 days together, the silence. The silence doesn't expect anything. The silence doesn't judge. The silence is infinitely patient. It's boundlessly spacious. It's totally accepting and allowing. This silence that everything arises out of and dissolves back into. It's really quite an amazingly precious aspect of a retreat, of the time we spend together. Sometimes if it's new for you, sometimes people feel a bit anxious about spending even a few minutes in silence with so many people, let alone days in silence in the company of so many people. Seems like it might be impossible or really awkward, strange. Well, I can say that it's not impossible. It may at moments feel awkward and strange, and that's okay. We feel awkward and strange at moments in the midst of lots of noise, too, so that's all right. I can truly say that for most people, by the end of a retreat, the silence was one of the most precious aspects of the retreat for them. Because it holds everything and doesn't hold on to anything. Everything simply comes and goes in the silence. This spacious, patient acceptance where you don't really have to be anybody. You don't have to present yourself. You just simply be. What an incredible opportunity to just simply be. And the silence allows us. It holds that. It allows that possibility. And in this respect, it's sometimes called noble silence. It has that sort of depth of quality, potentially. So really honor it, honoring yourself, your practice in the silence, and honoring everyone else's process also by offering the silence to yourself and others. And I think Oren spoke about some of the details of that. I'll just mention them very quickly again. There's often, if you brought things to read, there may be things around to read, I would encourage you not to read. You'll have plenty of time to read. 5 days are over and you can read all you want. I mean, sometimes I understand that what's going on in our mind, we'd rather fill it with something else, and so we read, you know. But let it be, just for now, this time, let it be. Don't fill it up with anything else. Also, and I think this was probably mentioned, but in terms of eye contact, direct eye contact is a wonderful thing. It's a very strong and powerful communication. And a great thing for us as humans to connect that way. But in the retreat, not as a rigid rule for yourself, but just be aware of not doing that. And when you do it, be aware of doing it. It's a kind of a strong communication that, for the moment, takes us out of ourselves. And often in that strong eye contact, we're asking for something back. So it also takes the other person out. So again, that gift of silence, of just letting yourself be and letting everyone else simply be. Explore, experiment with it, and see. See what that's like. Think of it as an experiment rather than some rigid rule that you have to follow. An exploration, an investigation. And I think the same with writing. Some of you may keep diaries as part of your life, as part of your practice, your own personal process. If that's so and you brought it with you, If you must write, just write a few lines. Don't write the next chapter of your book. Don't write your greatest poem. Just, if you need to note a few things, fine. After the retreat, you can fill it in. And if you can let it rest, let it rest. If you need to say something to me, ask me something that feels really pertinent and urgent, you can leave me a note. And I think that was probably already said, and the same with the managers. Rather than grabbing me or stopping me or stopping the manager somewhere, just let them know what you need by a note. Let us know and we'll respond. Again, an experiment to see just what that offers you. There's a wonderful poem by Pablo Neruda, a Chilean poet, that talks about silence. I'd like to share it with you. It's called Keeping Quiet. Now we'll count to 12, and we'll all keep still for once on the face of the earth. Let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales. And the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers and sisters in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it's about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. Thanks, dog. I'm not going yet. So we really have the perfect conditions here these next 5 days for our practice. As we begin to open to what is really a very deeply intimate experience. This connection of the heart, this intimacy with ourself, with all forms of life. And in this respect, we're really quite fortunate to be embodied as we are, in a human form, human body. This precious human existence that we have, and with all of the conditions, all of the opportunities, all of the blessings in place at this very moment for us to connect to these amazing teachings and this practice of the truth of our heart. It's said that those of us that have been fortunate enough to have this particular precious human existence, this precious human existence in this moment as it is, are as rare as daytime stars. So here we are, a whole room full of daytime stars. Sometimes at the beginning of the retreat, of a retreat, there's a mixture of a kind of excitement, maybe a kind of nervousness, anxiety, a lot of energy moving through our body, moving through our mind. I have a friend in the United States, in Massachusetts, at the Insight Meditation Society, where I lived for a number of years. And some years ago, he was about to enter into his, I think, fourth or fifth three-month retreat. And we had a talk the evening before he was about to enter in. And I said, "How do you feel? How are you feeling?" He said, "Well, I'm feeling the obligatory fear." This man had been, you know, this was his fourth or fifth three-month retreat. So if you're feeling a little nervous or anxious or excited and combinations of various energies, you're in good company. The company here and the company of those that have been practicing for many, many years also. Whenever I enter into teaching a retreat, it's always new, and there's always this kind of strong energy running through me. It's natural. New, something new. We feel that that energy, it's a natural part of our human process. Just lots of different qualities of energy, different flavors, different textures, coming and going. I'd like to talk a little bit about again, I think Oren mentioned this, what are formally called the precepts, the guidelines that help create this village, help create this harmony, this life together during these next 5 days. These guidelines are really about relationship. Essentially, it's about relationship. And they bring an ease of heart, of mind. As we begin to explore them as practice, use them as a ground, the kind of ground of our life together, the ground of our life maybe ongoingly, but certainly the ground of our life together here as we live together and practice together. There's a particular form of these guidelines, and I think of them as ethical relationship, a growing sensitivity into living ethically in relationship to all forms of life. And it is a practice. They're not heavy-handed orders. They're points of practice, points of exploration. We really learn from exploring our relationship to these guidelines and how we live them or how we don't live them and what that experience is in that. This particular rendition or form of the guidelines was written by a woman named Stephanie Kaza, who lives at a Zen community called Green Gulch Farm in the United States. And it's very beautiful, and to me captures the essence of what these guidelines are really about. So I'd like to read it to you. There is a translation, by the way. Is it up yet, Oren? A translation of this into Hebrew? It will be up, okay. Because some of the words may not be understandable yet, but it's fairly clear. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to kill. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not take what is not given. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not engage in abusive relationships. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not speak falsely or deceptively. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harm self or others through poisonous thought or substance. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not dwell on past errors. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not speak of self separate from others. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not possess any thing or form of life selfishly. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harbor ill will toward any plant, animal, or human being. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not abuse the great truth of the three treasures. The three treasures being the first, I sometimes call them jewels. The first jewel is the Buddha, which may or may not be an inspiration for you personally, but that's where these teachings come from and that's where these practices come from. And it really also means your true nature, your Buddha self, your the truth of who you are. That's the first jewel. The second jewel or second treasure is the Dharma, which really means the teachings, the way. And in some sense, it means everything, because there's nothing, there's no experience, no connection, no phenomena, nothing in our life that doesn't have the potential of revealing the truth. So everything is Dharma in that sense. Everything is a teaching. And the third treasure or jewel is the Sangha, which means community, this community of people. In the community of humans, of beings who have sought the truth from ever, forever, as long as there have been humans, those that have sought the truth in some way, wanted to understand deeply, wanted the freedom of that understanding. It also means specifically those humans that have taken vows of to be monks and nuns and let go of the sort of ordinary world and dived in that deeply into their practice. But it really truly means all the community of beings that have practiced towards understanding, deep understanding of the truth. So as we open to these guidelines as the ground of our practice, the ground of our spiritual life, we begin to actually feel more at ease. We begin to not expend so much energy worrying or trying to hide anything. Not feeling so guilty about this or that. Not trying to make up for anything, expending that kind of energy. As we begin to actually live more from the place of non-harming, which is really the essence of what the guidelines or the precepts are about, non-harming. Non-harming ourselves and all beings. So our energy is freed up. Our energy is opened up. We have more energy for practice. We have more energy for life itself. We begin to understand what Stephanie Kaza calls, because we are so intertwined, we begin to understand that we are interconnected. How deeply and how the depth of that truth, and in fact, we are interconnection. We are that. We begin to know that directly with experience, through our own experience. These guidelines, this moving more towards living with a ethical sensitivity really offers us that possibility. I'd like to explore a little bit with you what might be the seeds that bring us to a spiritual practice. What might be the seeds that bring us to a retreat like this? And I think I could safely say that for most of us, maybe all of us in our own particular ways, I think that the seeds of our practice or our potential practice are really the questionings, the deep wonderings, the deep yearnings, the kind of murmuring in our heart, the things that humans have forever asked and wondered about, regardless of culture, regardless of history, of race, as long as there have been human beings, these deep murmurings of the heart. Who am I? What's life about? What's death about? Can I be happy? What do I need to really be happy? What do I really need to be really at ease in this life? Can I live gracefully? How can I live gracefully? How can I live in grace in this life? With all that's going on within me and all that's going on around me. I think in some way that's essentially what the deepest maybe reasons that bring us to practice. And we all have lots of other reasons too, I'm sure. In the process of our lives, from our very earliest childhood on, we've always been looking for things, looking for people, looking for places, looking for jobs, knowledge, education, various situations, activities, to give us some kind of sustaining satisfaction, some kind of ongoing peace of mind, to fill our heart with an ongoing kind of boundless love and contentment and ease. And at least at times, most of our lives have been filled with an enormous amount of busyness, a lot of doing, a lot of achieving, a lot of performing, a lot of striving towards perfection, whatever that is. And it's different for each one of us, whatever that is. In this wish for love, for ease of well-being. Often in this doing, this trying to get this and that, to fulfill this, to make this happen, to feel this, we're trying to live up to images, or we're trying to create images that our cultures, our families, that ourselves set up for us. I was looking in a women's magazine and some time ago, and I found this advertisement, which to me was really said this image thing that we try so hard at times to create. It's an advertisement for makeup, for women's facial makeup. And I'll just read it. Wishing you look different is a major waste of time. Don't freak out over every flaw. And then it goes on to say, fix it and get on with it. Confusing, you know? Really confusing. Learn to see the positive, it goes on to say. There's no such thing as a plain Jane. In English, a plain Jane means sort of an ordinary-looking, sort of blah-looking person. And it's the name of the makeup is called Plain Jane, so they're wanting you to buy it so you can fix it. Very confusing. And that kind of message comes to us in so many different ways in our culture, and we take it on. Even if we're conscious of it, it's so, it's everywhere. And we take it on and we live it in so many different ways. And it doesn't help, actually. It doesn't bring us to what we really want. So both our inner world and our outer world isn't always a place of peace and calm and ease and open-heartedness. All of this striving, all of this doing and striving can sometimes be actually quite painful and quite uncomfortable, and in very specific ways for each of us. And in a general way, it takes its toll. It really costs us. We pay for it with our lives, so to say. And so I would imagine for each of us, there comes a time of questioning. Questioning these aspects of our lives. Maybe when they're more predominant. Maybe when there's more energy in them. Maybe just at times when we're more aware of them. When we're feeling them more. We might ask these questions. It's kind of like what the Quakers call this small, still voice within our heart. The questions come out of that place, that small, still place inside. And we know, really, in our heart, when we ask the question, in some sense, we know the answer. We have a sense of the answer. The question, in a sense, can be found, the answer can be found within itself, within our heart. We actually know that there's something different possible. I think maybe one of the very best times to ask ourselves what is really significant, what's really valuable in our experience. What do I really, really need to be happy? Is when we have, at least for the moment, drifted, or very consciously as you have, taken ourselves out of the fierceness of the current of the life around us and the fierceness of the current of all of our busyness in the midst of all of the life around us. Taken ourselves out of that for the moment. Moments like this, like right now, really one of the best times to ask the questions. And so we'll be exploring through the practice of metta our heart's capacity to heal itself, to feed itself, and to offer itself to ourself, offer ourself, our heart's capacity to ourself, offering the deepest, truest kindness, unconditional acceptance and then begin to touch, to know this really, truly boundless capacity that doesn't belong to anybody. It's available. It's our nature, really. As Nisargadatta said, you are love when you're not afraid. It's our nature. And then we take it out. We take it out and we bring in all the beings. All the beings into this love, offering it and bringing them in. This is from the Buddha. He talked about how incredibly powerful and consequential it is to experience just one moment, even just one moment, of a mind, of a heart, fully absorbed in the feeling of metta, in the feeling of unconditional loving kindness. It's said that love is the most powerful energy in the universe. And so we'll be practicing towards this capacity of our heart. I'd like to mention just a few qualities of heart, of mind. And by the way, I use the word, the words heart, mind interchangeably. I'll use it all the way through the days together here. In many Asian languages, the word for heart and mind is the same word. We pull ourselves apart, the mind and the heart. We're going to bring them together. So verbally, I try to do that partially by saying them, the words together. So a few qualities of heart-mind that I think will be useful for you, helpful for you to remember as we spend our days here together in practice. And the first is willingness. This quality of heart, quality of mind, of willingness. The willingness to come close to your heart. Touch it. Touch that energy. Not necessarily the physical heart, but the energy of heart, of love, of kindness. Sound. Whatever that sound is, and begin again with the practice of metta. The second quality of heart, of mind, is patience. And the Buddha actually spoke about patience a lot, which I think in the Dharma talk tomorrow night I'll talk about it a little more. He likened it to loving kindness itself. Patience, great patience. He spoke about it as the highest virtue. Patience with yourself in the practice. I think that real patience implies a very compassionate, loving place, space, a kind of will-see attitude. Impatience, the opposite of it. I want it now, this minute. This kind of open, spacious, will-see, compassionate heart. Patience. Even the I don't know. The place of I don't know. I don't know. That's patience. It's okay. I don't know. I don't have to know right now. Patience. And in this, there's an amazing thing that happens. We begin to have a faith in ourselves that we're actually doing our best with this kind of patient, loving attitude. We actually begin to know that we're doing our best. Someone called the active aspect of patience. I really like this. They called it hastening slowly. I don't know if hastening is a word some of you may not know. Quickly, going quickly, slowly. Doing it right now, slowly. Remember that. When you're when you're feeling yourself leaning into the practice, that kind of impatience, sit back, take a breath, keep doing it, but slowly, patiently. Offer yourself that gift. And the other aspect of patience is a very important one, actually. Not to push ourselves over our edge. We all have our capacity for being with ourselves in whatever a place that is at any given time, whatever's happening, and not to push ourselves over that. Very, very important. The amazing thing is that if we're patiently with ourselves at the edge, those edges keep moving further and further and further out. Our capacity keeps growing bigger and bigger and bigger. So really offering yourself the patience of your limitations, which are not solid, are not static. They'll keep changing. Your capacity keeps growing. Very important part of patience. There's a wonderful piece from Rainer Maria Rilke in his Letters to a Young Poet, when he speaks about patience to the young poet that he was corresponding with, and I'd like to just read you a small piece of that. There is here no measuring with time. No year matters, and 10 years are nothing. Being an artist, and by the way, meditation is an art. So being an artist means not reckoning and counting, but ripening like the tree, which does not force its sap and stands confident in the storms of spring without the fear that after them may come no summer. It does come, but it comes only to the patient, who are there as though eternity lay before them, so unconcernedly still and wide. I learn it daily, and sometimes learn it with pain, to which I am grateful. Patience is everything. So willingness and patience. And the third quality of mind, of heart, is courage. Sometimes people think courage is an odd word to use in a spiritual practice. But it's actually not odd at all. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to enter into inner work, in spiritual life, into a practice. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to be very honest with oneself. It takes a lot of courage to be patient with ourselves. Takes a lot of courage to be willing to come back again and again and again. Takes a lot of courage. And in a culture where it's not overall supported and encouraged to do this kind of work, it takes a lot of courage to do it. There was a period in my practice a number of years ago when my patience and my willingness and my courage was very thin, because practice was extremely difficult during that period. And I really wondered whether I would be able to continue with my practice. And then I had a memory, a kind of what sometimes happens in practice, an experiential memory. It wasn't really a thought, but a sense and a feeling, a memory. And what came back was a memory of kind of flooding in, was a memory of when I gave birth to my first children. They were two at the first birth because they were twins. And this memory came back of an enormous amount of courage and patience and willingness that was there, just there during that process of giving birth. It was just available. There was no question about it at that time. For whatever reason, there it was. And it was an incredible inspiration in this time of very difficult practice. Because essentially our practice is about giving birth to ourself, giving birth to the truth of our heart, the truth of the freedom of our heart, the release, the heart's release, as it's sometimes called. And so the memory, with that memory, I became filled again with some degree of willingness and patience and courage and continued on with my practice. Another aspect of courage, just to mention, the courage, the same as I spoke about with patience, and I'm going to probably talk about this again at some point in a different way, but the courage to not push ourselves too far too fast. The courage to actually honor our limitations, not give in to them, but honor them. Not pretending. Not some image of who we think we are or who we think we should be or who we think we shouldn't be, but to honor the truth of ourselves in the moment and our limitations. Sometimes with other people, it's easier to be patient and loving and courageous with our friends, with our family. But we can also begin to be that way with ourselves. Be our best friend, our own best friend. This is the practice of loving kindness, of learning to be a deep friend to ourselves. In these three qualities of heart, willingness, patience, and courage, we begin to develop a faith in the process and a faith in ourself in the process. And there's this very sustaining factor of the great energy of our own liveliness that sustains us in this, a kind of vigor, this innate brightness that really truly is who we are, is each of us, the bright truth of ourself, of our heart. And this is fueled, this truth is fueled by all of the seeds and the sparks of wisdom that are already within us, already present within us, and very available actually, very close. This natural inclination to touch the truth of our heart that brought us here is the wisdom that, in a sense, waters itself, the seeds of itself, into full blossom, into a full blossoming of the potential of our heart's release, of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and the balance of equanimity. I'd like to close the talk this evening by sharing with you the Metta Sutta, the original, as far as we know anyway, teaching from the Buddha on Metta. It's pretty short, and this is a translation in English that was made out of the Pali. Pali, the language that was spoken by the people during the time of the Buddha, and the language that the Buddha first taught in. This sutta, this teaching, was translated by monks from England, from the Amaravati Monastery in England. And actually, they chant it very beautifully. I don't know the melody of this chant, so I have to read it instead of chanting it. Someday I'll have to learn it because it's quite gorgeous. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So that's the Metta Sutta. I'd like to actually close the talk with one more thing. Since this is the eve of Purim, and I was told by a friend of mine something I didn't know about Purim, just last week actually, that there's a tradition, an old tradition, I think it's pretty old, that that rabbis get drunk on Purim, and that they get so drunk, they get drunk so drunk to the point of which they cannot tell the difference between Mordecai and Haman. So, a meta interpretation of that, Mordecai and Haman being metaphor for good and evil, and getting so drunk, not with alcohol, but with love, with the love of God, with the love of understanding, coming from a place of insight and understanding of all of the myriad, enormous amount of conditions that make Haman Haman and Mordecai Mordecai. The conditional nature of good and evil, and getting so drunk, so filled with love, with the love of understanding, with the understanding of love, that the two become one. So that's Purim and Metta. Let's just sit for a couple of moments together.
We began a bit late, and so we're a bit over time now.